WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehr. The search is on for a new leader for the Securities and Exchange Commission. Chairwoman Mary Shapiro announced this week that she is leaving next month. It leaves the agency charged with regulating Wall Street without a leader as key financial reform rules are still being finalized. And as we're still dealing with the question, why haven't more people been charged after this financial crisis? That's the question at the heart of a new book by a group of scholars. It's called How They Got Away With It: White Collar Criminals and the Financial Meltdown. It's edited by academics at John Jay College and looks at the roots and consequences of the crisis through a lens of criminology. Here with me is one of the editors, Susan Will, professor of and sociologist at John Jay College, and Saskia Sassen from Columbia University and a contributor to the book. Welcome to WNYC.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
I want to start with a clip from a conversation earlier this week here on The Brian Lehr Show. We talked to Neil Barofsky, who oversaw TARP, otherwise known as the bank bailout, and he joined us to talk about the legacy of outgoing Securities and Exchange Commission Chairwoman Mary Shapiro. I think we're going to go to that clip in a minute, but one of the things he talked about was that she did a lot to try to get the SEC in line to deal with to change after the financial collapse, and that she didn't quite get the major cases that people were looking for, that judges had said, compared it to coins and couch cushions and that sort of thing. But one of the things that I think is interesting about the book is it points out that this is not just about federal regulators. This is about something that has been in the works for decades and decades, going back to even the beginning of the Great Depression. So, Susan Wells, sort of give us the scope of this book. How did they get away with it? We're not just talking about bankers. We're talking about the whole way the American economy changed in the latter half of the 20th century. So how did they get away with it, and what's been our role as Americans and how the economy has changed?
Well, there's multiple ways you can look at it. And one of the things that I wrote about myself in the book has to do with the fact that I believe we're in a Ponzi culture, that the American people have bought into this idea that you can make huge profits without any costs. And we have gone through cycles of financial crises and re-regulation and then deregulation again, because we have very short memories and we kind of want to grab for that brass ring and never seem to succeed, or very few seem to really succeed at it.
So you say a Ponzi culture sort of pervades not just Wall Street, but the American economy, and you point to things like public pensions. You point to things like private retirement accounts. So my question is kind of, how much is this affecting the political will for major financial, regulation and reform, when at the end of the day, a lot of people have money invested in Wall Street? They're looking at their accounts. They feel somehow like they're told that if they put a little bit in over years, they'll get more and more and more returns. How culpable are we in terms of the American people and what we expect from Wall Street?
Well, part of it is that we always believe that we are going to be on the winning side. People have referred to this as a casino economy, and that they forget that the house holds all the cards and that the house tends to win most of the time. And we really want to see that we can succeed. It's part of the American dream. And one of the other authors in the book, Jock Young, talks about how we've bought into this way of conducting ourselves. And we forget about the pitfalls. People have forgotten about the lessons that they've learned during the Great Depression. And they think they can actually make something out of nothing.
Saskia Sassen, one
Lots
of the things.
Of S's, I know.
Yes, it's a beautiful name. One of the things you write about that I think is so interesting is the way the financial industry changed after 1989, specifically in the increase of financialization. And you talk about the logics of what yes. what kind of drove that. And you basically make the argument that as financial instruments got more sophisticated, it allowed capitalism to get more crude. So kind of explain how that happened.
Well, yes. I mean, what I say is that we have produced enormous complexity. Truly, I mean, the mathematics that is used to construct those algorithms is the mathematics of physicists. In other words, those whose task it is to track what cannot be seen, what cannot be measured. So that is extremely important. It's not the mathematics of microeconomics, which closes its system up and then sort of tries to replicate and to sort of prove in a way that they are right. So it is a totally different world. But out of that enormous complexity, with all these brilliant, like Goldman Sachs had 100 physicists in the back room, not the secretaries, the physicists in the back room, out of that came the outcome was the financializing of more and more. For instance, now we have financialized food crops. They were commodities. We have financialized the commodities. And that explains partly this extraordinary increase in the price of food. But I think one thing is this complexity in order to really hit all economic sectors. The United States has an extremely financialized economy. Now, the second point is, how does finance produce value? So the value of financial assets is $630 trillion. That is almost 15 times global GDP. So you stand back and you admire this. My God, what kind of brilliant creativity gets to that? Well, it has left us with an enormous crisis. But finance is foundationally different from traditional banking. Traditional banks sell what they have. They sell money they have. Finance sells what it does not have. And out of that comes both its extraordinary creativity in terms of developing the instruments. And secondly, and this often is not sufficiently recognized, it needs to invade other sectors. It doesn't have the option. So it has to invade whatever sector it can. So now they're invading used car loans. Not fancy whatever cars. No, used cars. Student loans, because they aggregate. I mean, they are the ultimate aggregator. So little loan, hey, multiplied by millions, and there you have it. So there is a structural aspect of finance that means that we, I think, can never regulate it. What we can is build walls where it cannot invade sectors. So, you know, but it will always be ahead. And, of course, most of finance is what they call the dark pools. It's private. We don't measure it. The estimate is that 70% of finance, you know, the trading of finance in the last 10 years was, you know, we don't know exactly. There are estimates.
So the invasion of the logic of financialization into other sectors, we need to build walls. Have we
to
built,
prevent that.
Have we built such walls after the financial collapse?
Glass-Steagall actually was pretty good. You know, it is extraordinarily radical, the difference between the post-1980s, which really begins in the mid-1980s, and the Keynesian period, when banks were banks, finance and the stock market were rather weak. We had banks everywhere in the country because it was about selling what you had, money. You didn't need brilliant, a backroom full of physicists. And then Glass-Steagall kept things more or less in place. And then in the early 80s, we had the disaster with all the little banks that went broke, you know, the trust resolution, whatever commission. So I think we can do something about finance that keeps it from being so destructive. But regulating is not. We have to create walls. That is my opinion. No, I think there are many different opinions, but it seems to me that that's the way to go.
I mean, seeing the financial sort of logic and financial industry as something that needs to be separate from other parts of the economy, I think is at odds with this idea that that Wall Street and the financial industry is what enables everything in the economy.
That's right. But it has gotten itself into that place. And that is why it is so complicated now. It is into everything because it is so invasive.
And I think that's part of the problem is that we buy the story that the financial industry puts out. We're accepting it without a critical eye. Instead of going back to what Saskia said about the Glass-Steagall having the separation, banks were doing perfectly well. Thrifts giving home mortgages. People could see where their money was and understand that by putting money in, you know, it's a wonderful life, how that operated. And when we had the first savings and loan crisis, people lost some of the sight of what was supposed to be normal from the deregulation that took place at that time. And then it was made more complete with the dissolution of Glass-Steagall, and people didn't even realize that the separation between finance and regular banking had disappeared. And finance is really getting more into gambling than it is actually supporting businesses and industry.
Well, I think that this anxiety was at the heart of the presidential election, talking to voters, because this idea that we had moved away from I'm saving money and then I'm going to spend it, that had the federal government and the financial industry had gotten so kind of complex and out of control, there was this sense of a loss of control. And I think for many voters that I talked to, there was a sense that we need to pull back and sort of be more conservative, fiscal conservatism. I think we saw that in some of the, you know, the appeal of the Republican presidential campaign for some. But you are arguing, Saskia Sassen, I will get it, that the one things we need to do is actually spend more money on material things as opposed to in this sort of world of financialization.
Well, you know, I mean, I want to clarify, in a way, we need finance. Finance makes capital. Banking takes a very long time to make capital. So if we want to build a green transport system, if we want to build social housing, my favorite two examples here. I mean, there are other options too. We actually need finance. But finance needs to be confined to a certain cycle. In other words, it can't just keep on, you know, creating the casino effect, the Ponzi scheme. And it has to be contained to certain sectors. And I do think that so we need finance, but we need also a state that regulates and that regulates the walls around it. That is what I would say.
And I want to ask you, Susan Will, about just looking at the financial crisis and its aftermath through the lens of white-collar criminology. That's the subtitle of the book. What exactly does that mean, and what do we gain by looking at it in terms of what happens when white-collar crimes are prosecuted?
Well, first of all, using the lens of white-collar crime or looking at the criminality that's involved is important to get the absolute realization that what happened wasn't just an accident. It was something that individuals calculated, planned, and carried out. Some things ended when banks act badly or financial institutions were acting badly. The economy did not correct them and did not discipline them, which is kind of the underlying thing of capitalism, that if, you know, bad actors are going to be punished. Instead, they were allowed to carry on, and others, seeing that they were going to lose business if they didn't join in and do the same thing, then did join in and carry on the same way as the bad actors. And so they weren't disciplined, but there was kind of a contagion. And unless the bad actors are disciplined and told what they are doing is wrong, and we're going to continue the cycle of having crime being perpetrated, committed, and not prosecuted. Now, back when the savings and loan crisis hit, it took a while But eventually, regulators did crack down on the bad actors, and there were large number of people who actually served time, paid huge penalties. And so a message was sent out, you can't do this. With this crisis, we've had a few bad actors identified, but we're identifying bad apples instead of looking at a system that is actually bad. And there aren't consequences being paid by these individuals. There have been a couple cases where prosecution was put forward. They've lost the case, and so it seems like the prosecutors are stepping back and saying it's not what we're not the direction we're going to go. We're going to find them instead.
Well, that's what I find is so interesting about this book. It brings in the economic history, some of the social factors, the relationships between the financial industry and government, where regulation failed and where we are all culpable in this. The book is How They Got Away With It, White Collar Criminals and the Financial Meltdown. Susan Will, a co-editor and sociologist at John Jay College, Saskia Sassen, sociologist at Columbia University. Thanks so much for joining us at WNYC.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.